and welcome to No Books on a Dead Planet, the podcast where we read climate books so you don't have to. Don't even bother. In this economy, reading climate books? I don't think so. We're doing it for you. Today, I am joined by the wonderful Hannah McGregor, who is a professor, podcaster, and writer. You might know them as one of the founding hosts of Witch Please. And so I'm experiencing a deep sense of intimate publics here because I feel like Hannah's voice has been in my bathroom so often. But you yourself have never been in my bathroom. But Witch Please is one of, I'm ready to say it, my favorite podcast ever. Witch Please has now become a production company that makes amazing podcasts like Material Girls, which is my new favorite podcast. And I've also been a guest on there if you want to go and be nosy. And also Gender Playground. Hannah, you're also the author of a book called Sentimental Education. But I recently saw that you have another book coming out in September about Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I do. It's called Clever Girl, and it is a very short book, just a series of essays that give a queer feminist reading of Jurassic Park as a sort of iconic feminist film about monstrous women rising up and devouring the men who would control them.
Dinosaurs and rage. Yeah. Sign me up. I was such a fraidy cat little kid that I've never seen Jurassic Park. So for you, I will have to watch it for context.
Lena,
I know.
Got to. It's
I was terrified.
Really good.
I'm afraid of everything. I trust. I've never thought it's. In fact, the reason I'm avoiding it is because it looks good and therefore looks convincing. And I'm like, dinosaurs could be possible.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's less scary if you remember that the dinosaurs are the heroes.
Okay. That's going to, so maybe I should read your book first and then Jurassic Park afterwards. Maybe
actually,
that's the
yeah.
bar.
Yeah.
Let's do it that way for me, for the timid.
Yeah. Read the book, watch the movie, read the book again.
Homework set. I'm done. I'm nothing if not obedient. Is there anything I missed in the intro that you think listeners like need to know about all the stuff that you do, Hannah, before we dive in?
I mean, nothing that's pertinent to them.
None of their business.
There's other things I do. You know, if you're in Vancouver, you come take a course with me.
Professor life. I love it.
Yeah.
So when I have guests on, I usually send a little list of like suggested titles of things we could read. And I sent you over the suggestion of the book, Love After the End. Tell me a little bit about what made you pick that one, because certainly I sent it to you because it's written by Canadian people and that was as far as the thought process honestly went. So yeah. Tell me why you picked it, apart from my rampant generalizations. I was like, Canadian people like to read Canadian people. I know that.
Canadian people do like to read Canadian people. I love reading Canadian books. This book is actually published by Arsenal Pulp Press, which is a really fabulous independent press located right here in East Vancouver, where I live. That is, in fact, you know, employs one of my best friends. So, you know, there's a little bit of
economic incentive here.
But Arsenal is such a cool press. It is the first press in Canada ever to be run by a queer person of color, Brian Lamb, who's a queer Asian Canadian man. It was publishing queer literature when like queer books were still getting like seized at the border. So a real like groundbreaking press in terms of publishing queer authors, trans authors, Indigenous authors, BIPOC authors. And they publish so many great people, including, of course, Joshua Whitehead, who is a fabulous writer who is also like kind of a friend of mine, as is Jay Simpson, who's also in this anthology. So like, again, it's like, oh, it's my pal.
I've just read a book by your friends.
Yeah, you've just read a book by my friends.
I did find this book independently. But it has, its reputation has preceded it. I have heard good things about it already. So I'm glad that I was like, it's obviously the book has magnets in it. It was being drawn towards you. It makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, Canada's very small. And I'm very well connected. But it is one of those books that, like, I know so many of the people involved. I, you know, have seen people talk about it, but it just hadn't made its way to the top of my reading pile. And so when you suggested it, it was one of those beautiful kismet, like, oh, good, I'll have a reason to put this at the top of the pile and actually sit down and read it. So thank you.
Oh, no problem. I always find that even the stuff I really want to do, like, it does still require a deadline. And I don't know what that is about me, but maybe it's the same for you. It's like, even the good stuff needs
maybe
a deadline.
refer to the aforementioned conversation about capitalism and the way in which it constrains our lives.
maybe, potentially. So I was actually looking at some interviews with Joshua about this book because I was like trying to find ways to summarize it for the people listening. And I love this quote from him. He said, Indigenous authors are like prime examples of already having survived multiple genocides. We're kind of like the Mad Max experts of how to survive the apocalypse. We've been doing it since 1492, which I thought was a really interesting thing. And also in the introduction, they talk about how the original plan was to make it a dystopian collection of stories. And mm-hmm. in the end, they decided to make it an anthology of utopias, which I thought was really, really interesting. So I'm assuming that you kind of had an impression of a little bit of what this book might be like before you read it. Was it what it turned out to be in your head? Like, did it surprise you? Or was it?
You know what? It did surprise me a little bit because I am used to the kind of like sci-fi dystopian literature that literary presses publish being a little less overtly engaged with genre than this collection is. And I had forgotten that originally it was going to be published with Bedside Press, which then closed right in the middle of the process of the publication. And so Arsenal picked it up. But Bedside was like a very genre-oriented press. So the stories are actually more like hard sci-fi-esque than I was expecting, in a way that I really enjoyed because I am a sci-fi fan and I really love the way that the authors are sort of playing within the recognized conventions of the genre. And we can talk about that more, but there's a lot of like really fun, interesting genre play. But I also had some sense that they were going to be playing with the idea of dystopia and utopia, because this is a thing that I've heard a lot of Indigenous writers talk about, is this idea that the sort of current moment of climate crisis and the dystopian imagination that settlers are using to work through this moment has a really different temporality than how Indigenous writers and thinkers are engaging with the idea of dystopia, because for Indigenous folks, they are multiple generations into the apocalypse. Like, it happened. It happened hundreds of years ago. They are living in the ruins of what was, you know, a world that was destroyed by settler colonialism. And so there is a different relationship to futurity, a different relationship to notions of apocalypse, and I think a different relationship to ideas of hope.
That definitely
I as a reader feel like I can learn a lot from.
Something I noticed as a kind of thread, there was definitely for me, I haven't read a huge amount of speculative fiction or sci-fi, I'll say that, but for me it was like a lot of like in the characters' minds, a framework of how community functions within a panic. And the fact that in a lot of the short stories, communities were already organizing, there was already a network of people, and especially to squeeze that into short stories was really artful. And I felt like some of the short stories I was reading, and I was like, this obviously must be an extract from a novel. And then I look it up and I'll be like, it's not. They've just created this whole framework and all this, like the different networks and the way things interact. I was just like, I think for me, that was like really, really noticeable.
Yeah, they drop you into this world that's so richly structured around community and kinship right from the beginning.
Totally. And I think also, like, you just made me think about something, because I always say, like, oh, you know, climate conversations can be awkward, we don't know how to have them, they feel sad, they feel like doom laden. But again, I think that's also probably the place that I grew up and where I'm from, is that like we haven't had to have the awkward sad conversations before, whereas these like people have been having them just without us. So again, that's complicated.
And if you learn to listen to those conversations, there is a lot to learn about, particularly for me, about sort of endurance in the face of crisis and what it means to like stay with a thing that feels hard and overwhelming. Like who better to learn those skills from than people who have spent multiple generations like staying with the almost impossible task of surviving through the genocidal project of settler colonialism and like maintaining culture, maintaining kinship, recovering language, recovering ritual, and rebuilding in the wake of an attempt on the part of you know, what is currently known as Canada, like an attempt to destroy a world.
Yeah.
A failed attempt, but like we can, there's so much to learn there.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it reminds me of one of the best stories I think in there is called The History of the New World. And in that, it's a couple and their child who have an opportunity, like an extra secret opportunity to leave Earth for somewhere potentially safer. And it's a one-way shuttle. And like, once you're through the barrier, you can't get back. And there's a disagreement between the two parents, whereas one wants to stay and one wants to go, and one is Indigenous and one isn't. And the Indigenous one wants to stay because they're like, well, this is where I'm, like, if the planet dies, I die. Like, I am kind of part of the planet. I don't think leaving and recolonizing another planet is the answer. And the other one's like, peace out. I'm getting on the shuttle. And it's like, God.
Yeah.
Really on the nose, but really interesting and chilling. And
really on the nose, but so beautifully played out in terms of, like, what that actually looks like in the moment. And that was something that struck me so much. I mean, yeah, the kinship I think is so vital, and the fact that in the imagining of almost all or all of these stories, the earth itself is kin. And so you don't abandon the earth. The fantasy, the utopian fantasy, is not abandoning the earth and going finding somewhere that we haven't fucked up yet. Because that's not what you do to kin, even if it's sick, even if it's dying, even if you might also die. Like, you don't just abandon her.
Yeah, totally. It's, yeah, and then the couple go and find an actual, like, one of the only stable communities in that short story is the Rainbow People's Camp, which is a group of Indigiqueer people who have already, like, set up a little thing that they're like, we're going to try and survive. God. Question mark.
The moment when they arrive and then they hear their language spoken as they're calling to them through the barricade that they've set up is so, like, made me cry.
Yeah. And he's like, am I doing it right? And you're like, oh God, it's a lot. And were there any stories for you that really stuck out? I mean, I have a list of things that I'm like, God, I don't even heard of these, like, some of these things before, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was also my favorite, but I particularly liked the way that one sat alongside Jay Simpson's story, which I'm gonna double check the title of that one.
That's the Ark of the Turtle's Back, right?
Remember. Yeah, that is the Ark of the Turtle's Back.
Yes!
Good memory. Good job.
Do I get points, Professor?
A+.
Please. I just want to win. Sorry.
Yes, you're winning. No, you're doing it. You're doing it. Good job. Because that one, like, is building around a similar premise of, like, we have truly destroyed the earth and we've got to go. But in that one, in the Ark of the Turtle's Back, they do go. And so it's, you know, the other side, like, what if there is no choice? Well, then what do you do? And one of the I think, very evocative things that story is doing is sort of entangling questions about our relationship with Earth versus our potential relationship with other places that are mediated through science, with our protagonist, who is a trans woman who gets surgery so that she can have children. And that itself becomes a sort of way that she becomes aligned with the earth and the capacity for motherhood, and that, like, the scientific intervention isn't automatically, like, violent or negative, but rather a sort of ability to move into, like, the possibility of birthing a future for her community that wasn't available to her before. So the thinking about how, like, as a trans-centered narrative, it rethinks our relationship to nature and science and pushes back on an idea that, like, science is bad and we need to, like, quote unquote, return to nature. That like binary is really sort of unraveled through that narrator. And then we get this like beautiful moment at the end where she's like, all right, well, what do we, like, how do we get to know a new planet?
And how do we become indigenous?
Yeah. And the response that she gets is like, well, you know, the same way that you start any new relationship, you ask it out.
Yeah, such a good line.
Perfect.
Gonna romance it. But you're right, I think I hadn't thought about it like that. That it's the idea that, like, trans experiences can actually further like a community task of like recreation and stuff like that, rather than it being something that's like, oh, we're going against the grain, we're doing something really awkward over here. It's like actually contributing to the community by becoming who we are. I think it's really, really cool.
The other thing that I really enjoy about Indigenous sci-fi in general is the way, as a genre, it rejects a kind of ongoing placement of indigeneity in the past and instead insists, like, not only that Indigenous culture is, like, contemporary and engaged with technology, but also that Indigenous culture extends into the future. And, like, these imaginings, you know, the first story, what's the first story called, Lena? One about the sexy rat.
Oh, Abacus.
Abacus.
So sexy. Steamy.
Yeah, what a sexy rat. I love that he's got... Anyway. that, like we're on a space station in the future, hanging out in VR, and just this, like, artificial intelligence cyborg rat is indigenous.
Yeah, of course.
And there's no...
Why not?
There's like, yeah, no, it just is. Like, don't... Indigeneity still exists. Like, Anishinaabe characters exist in the future. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, totally. And I think I read that story very, like, just before bed, which is a very weird, like, sexy rat AI story to read before bed. But I think I remember it being, like, the relationship, but the same-sex relationship wasn't taboo. It was the relationship between a human and a cyborg that was the queerness of their relationship in that point in the future as well, which was really, really interesting.
Yeah, it wasn't even the rat thing that was taboo. Yeah,
the rat thing was fine. Rodents pass.
Yeah.
I think that also the idea that Joshua mentions in the introduction of, like, two-spirit and indigiqueer people are the wildest kinds of biopunks was so interesting as well. Like, your idea of this thing being like science is actually part of nature and part of, like, us evolving is so cool. And I heard the word biopunk before. Is that a term that I should know?
You know what? I also hadn't heard it before, but I love it.
Oh, they're starting a new thing. It's so interesting. And the other story that I really liked was The Seed Children, which is about a non-binary person who tries to save a group of bioengineered / cyborg children. I couldn't really tell if they were bioengineered or whatever they were. They didn't have technically original human flesh, and they were then therefore second-class citizens in this world. And she's like, they're like off there trying to save the children. But they're cyborg children.
Yeah. Oh, you know what other one I really loved was the one about Jennifer, the therapist, who is, like, working in a, you know, her story's sort of set in the present day, and she's, you know, a functioning alcoholic. She's an Indigenous therapist who, like, works with Indigenous patients, often who are, like, on parole. And she's, like, pretty despairing. And there's a lot of, like, subtext about, like, you know, the context in which she's working and how that relates to what currently exists in terms of, like, Native run healing centers and, like, the very beginning of what we're seeing in North America of like some legal control or some sort of legal agency being returned to First Nations. So, like, we've got, you know, there's little sort of glimmers of stuff that's happening right now. But then the other half of the story is an ancestor of hers who's learning how to walk through dreams to speak to their ancestors, and she's the ancestor they're going back to speak to. And that idea of like thinking about yourself right now in the present moment, living through like the bleak hardships of late capitalism, being an ancestor for a generation that's going to come down the line, and like what it means to act as an ancestor, I also find really like compelling and hopeful as a way of thinking about, you know, our relationship to the moment we're living in.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it also like complicates that conversation around, oh, should I have children because the planet's on fire? It's like, well, either way, I'm sorry, but the way blood works means you'll have ancestors anyway. So maybe just worry about them in general.
Yeah, yeah. That like, I mean, that's such a wildly fraught conversation. But, you know, the way that I experience kinship is that like, the fact that I haven't biologically reproduced doesn't mean that I don't have children that I love.
Yeah.
Who like totally. Who I would like to have a future.
Yeah. And also the idea that like you have to know future children to care about them as well is like so interesting. It's like, oh well, I don't want to have children in the future because I don't want to know the people who will suffer. Like I don't want to be biologically related to the people who will suffer. That upsets me. Yeah. Whereas I'm like it's just, yeah.
It's like, oh, you just want it to be other people's children. Cool.
Yeah, you're like,
neat.
Brilliant. Good to know.
Neat attitude.
Yeah, it's, wow. I mean, the human brain has an amazing capacity for weird thought processes. I don't think any of us are following a logical trajectory. So, you know, forgiveness all around, because I'm sure I have weird hop, skips and jumps in my brain. But I think it's been
not
something
me,
I've been thinking
beep,
about.
Boop, I'm a robot.
Yeah, yeah, you're like, it's only logic here, logic and steel. How do you find climate conversations in your life in general? I'm really interested in like all of the different guests' answers to this, because I think it can really vary depending on who you have in your life and how much capacity you have for it.
Yeah.
And I think that literature is an amazing way to get into talking about it without having to like get too, you know, into the weeds. But yeah, how do you 100%. Find climate conversations in general?
I have been having very serious climate conversations with my loved ones for many years now, because living in BC, we are very much at the front door of the climate crisis. We are experiencing very vividly and in real time the way in which the landscape around us is getting ravaged by particularly wildfires. So, you know, I think 3 years ago there was, we set like record high temperatures in BC to the point that an entire town burned down, like the whole town burned down because it was so hot. Frequently now in the summers, there are weeks at a time where the sky over BC is so clogged with wood smoke that you can't go outside, like the air stops being breathable. And that was happening like through the height of the pandemic. So you were having these like, okay, well, I can't spend time inside with people because it's not safe, but I also can't go outside because it's not safe. And you know, I am also experiencing with my community what it means, for example, for like temperatures to be rising really, really quickly in a city that was not built for very high temperatures, and housing policy is not keeping up. So there's no requirements yet for people to be provided with heat pumps or air conditioning in their homes. So people are dying of heat exposure. And, you know, we're figuring out as community how to be like, okay, like, can we get this person an air conditioning unit? Can we, like, how do we make sure that we're checking in on people and that people are okay? So it feels very present in my life and very practical in a lot of ways. Like, we're having practical conversations about, like, all right, we're still going to be livable in 20 or 30 years. Like, where will we go? How will we try to keep each other alive? Like, you know, I've got some beloved friends who are basically like queer disability justice oriented preppers at this point. So like prepping, but without the fantasy of total isolation.
Community
sort of prepping based in, yeah, community prepping. Exactly. And so I would say like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, climate conversations still felt completely terrifying and completely overwhelming to me. Like a kind of panicked, oh my God, what do we do? And I think I have moved through that stage for now. I am fairly convinced things are going to get worse and I will experience new versions of that stage as things continue to develop. But for me, reorienting the conversation around community care has been really helpful for that feeling of overwhelm and powerlessness.
So I mean, like the answer to the question, what can I do? It's like, well, I can get somebody an air conditioner. Like there's a lot of practical,
yeah,
like direct solutions to personal problems at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting because hearing you talk about that and visiting the really good friend I have in Canada, it's very like, it's just so different in Britain. Like everyone's just overjoyed to have a slightly nicer summer. And a slightly more bearable winter. And like British people, the stiff upper lip is so, it's prevalent. So I think it's really interesting having conversations with people across the pond, because I think it is really hard to get people into that. And I think, again, like when I'm thinking about books to recommend people, I didn't go into this book being like, oh, this is a good starter pack climate book. But actually, I think from a facts perspective, when people can't hear facts, it's actually nice to hear realistic stories. I mean, they're realistic in the fact that I don't know if people are going to be having hot and steamy moments with AI rats in the future, but realistic in that it's not all happy and everything was fine and nobody died kind of climate utopia conversations, but more like there will be a future and here are some options of how things could go. It's actually like weirdly it's kind of working backwards rather than reading about the climate facts, which a lot of people just avoid. I think maybe like going in from it from a fictional like relationship based perspective to being like thinking about one family or one collection of people or one person or one therapist, rather than it being this like, right, so yeah, let me explain how CO2 works.
Yeah.
Brain immediately shuts down. What is carbon?
I feel like
the eyes glaze over.
There's so often a mismatch between how climate communication is happening and the extent of agency that we have as individuals, right? That like what we're hearing about are problems that are so outside of our particular scope. And they're frequently not married with conversations about action, like conversations about organizing, right? Like our generation in particular, I think, grew up with a very individualistic attitude towards what we could do to take care of the climate. And now we're all hearing that is like utterly insufficient and may indeed have been propaganda created by the oil and gas industry to stop us from noticing what they were doing as corporations. And we were like, I'm recycling. And it's like, oh, that does fuck all. Oops. And so it's like, oh, I've only been taught that individual actions are effective. And it turns out my individual actions aren't effective. And so there's nothing I can do. And also all of the scientists are saying it's too late. So I think that the combination of all of those things tends us towards despair. I see this in my students all the time, that like the climate is so present in their minds and they feel so helpless. They feel so lacking in agency. And for me, you know, the conversations about organizing, about political action, about social transformation, those hinge on hope. Like they hinge on us believing that we can do something as people and that it is worthwhile trying. And so that's, you know, for me, one of the places that literature is really powerful is that it like reminds us that like, even though things are pretty dire, like you still gotta fucking give it a go, my dude.
Yeah, can't get off now.
No. Nope.
I think, yeah, you're right. And I think that hinges a lot on trust. And I think we've been taught not to trust that if you do your bit, other people will do their bit. You know, like they want to have an answer. It's like, if I do this, will it get better? And I'm like, only if everybody else does. And you got to start trusting them and also awkwardly talking to them. Because if you don't join up your actions, nothing happens. So there's a lot of conversations to be had, I think. And I think it's also, yeah, it's very hard to fit that in between everybody else's thoughts about their own life and what's going on for them and the cost of living crisis. And it kind of like cruelly really adds up, and it makes complete sense in the conversation and also feels like a distraction for people. So I think it's getting in through fiction.
Yeah.
Is a really good way forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, an antidote to despair that I think is important.
Mm. Are there any like examples that like you find that make you feel hopeful, or are you definitely in the despair section of thinking?
No, I'm hopeful. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm hopeful because, I mean, in part, I think I'm hopeful because I don't know how to be any other way. I'm hopeful because I'm a historian in part, and history is equally full of unbelievable human suffering and repair, and is a kind of constant cycle of destruction and repair. And that, you know, there's no reason to believe bad things won't happen in the future because they've always happened in the past. And also people hold each other up. You know, like we're not all going to get through it, but we're not all going to get through anything. So that's just life. But for me, watching the, you know, even the sort of small actions that people are taking having an effect, like, you know, this bird species was endangered and a bunch of people worked really hard to restore its, you know, traditional nesting grounds, and now it's coming back. And it's like, okay, so we can't actually fix some things. Like, we won't fix anything if we bury our heads in the sand, but like, and we're not gonna get through this without like significant suffering, and suffering that's gonna be really disproportionately, like, unevenly distributed. But all evidence points to repair being possible.
Yeah. Definitely. And I think it can be so general to be like, oh yeah, these parts won't be fixed and these parts will. But I think, yeah, you're right. I think this kind of idea that the past was better and it's going to get worse. There's so much to learn from reading about history and being like, actually, I think the past was kind of awful. And this is actually, even though everything is happening, I'm like, this is the best time to be born. Like 1990, what a sweet spot. Couldn't have asked for more. Like, yeah. Raping your wife became illegal when I was one. Love it. Would not have wanted to be born before that. And then now we're in a period where things are, and on some level, some parts of it are still fixable, and we're still able to have conversations on the internet.
Yeah.
And eat crisps and like watch films. And
that conversation has also got to be like, okay, it's probably the best time thus far to be born white in the Western developed world. Like, and the degree to which it's good to be white in the Western developed world also has to do with the degree to which it sucks to live in a lot of other parts of the world. Parts of the world where, in fact, it might have been a lot better to be born 500 years ago, before white people came along and fucked up your whole country.
Yeah,
fair. So like that also, you know, it depends on who you are and how you're located, which is, again, brings us back to that like reminder that the temporalities of apocalypse are unevenly distributed, and that a lot of the pleasures of modernity for some of us have come at the expense of others. And so those steps back, those moments of greater perspective of saying like, yeah, I feel really scared. Of course I feel really scared. What's happening is really scary. And taking that step back and being like, okay, shit, wow, the world's always been really scary for somebody, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Like that, you know, that is the human condition, because we are self-conscious animals, and what a nightmare.
Yeah, totally. And the idea that like you move from dystopia to utopia, or from utopia to dystopia, and it's like actually sometimes it's been very cyclical, and there are utopias and dystopias happening all over the world all the time, and people can have their utopia taken away from them by other unfavorable people.
100%.
I think that's a good place to end. <Don't you? laughs> What a nice little sprinkle on the top of your day to end things with. Hannah, tell us a little bit about what, if people wanted to look you up and look at more of your work, would you want them to go straight to order Clever Girl, Jurassic Park? Or would you want them to go over to Gender Playground podcast or Material Girls podcast? Or you have a podcast called Feminist something. I've forgotten
Secret
in the moment.
Secret Feminist Agenda. It's,
yeah. Wow, what a bad fangirl. Failed.
Yeah, you're in trouble. Yeah, your A-plus is, no, is on the
not
line.
Not with the press, not with the professor.
If you want to interact with me, the only place to do that is on Instagram at HKPMcGregor. Which is the initials for my secret middle names. If you want to learn more about my podcasts, they're all at awitchplease.ca. Material Girls is the podcast that I make with my co-host Marcel Cosman, where we use critical theory to talk about popular culture and explain why things have been zeitgeisty. And if you want to hang out with me and talk about speculative fiction more, then I make a Patreon exclusive series called Making Worlds, where I talk to people about sci-fi and fantasy and speculative fiction and the ways in which it allows us to imagine the world otherwise. So you can find that at patreon.com/awitchplease.
What a platter, a tapas of different worlds to explore. I love it. Well, thank you so much for generously buddy reading this book with me. And as we both responded to a deadline, I'm really glad that we both read it, because it's definitely been a bit of a game changer for me.
Yeah, I absolutely.
My compliments to all of your friends.
I'll let them know.
Tell all your friends I loved it.